rate upwards of 62%. You can help the homeless with your support for Chapman Partnership. Details at 877-548-6369 or chapmanpartnership.org.
Support for NPR Newscast comes from Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation created to do what Andrew Carnegie called real and permanent good, celebrating 100 years of philanthropy.
And it is today's topical currents, Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman on this afternoon. Well, this hour we talk about the art and science of conversation with Dr. Ben Benjamin. He's the co-author of Conversation Transformation, Recognize and Overcome the 6 Most Destructive Communication Patterns. And Dr. Ben Benjamin joins us from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hello, Doctor. Good afternoon.
Thank you for having me. Hello. Good afternoon.
So tell us about the most common mistakes we make during conversations, and how do they become destructive?
Well, the biggest problem is that people are not aware that they're making mistakes. You know, there are things in life we know that we don't know, and then there are things in life that we don't know that we don't know. You know, for example, if you're being sarcastic in a certain environment, you can be insulting people or putting daggers in them and not really know if sort of that's the way it was in your family. If somebody said, "Oh my, we're kind of fat today, aren't we?" You know, just you know, something completely bizarre like that. You know, or people would. Someone came to me who I was coaching and said, "Well, I just asked my this person a question and they started attacking me." And I said, "Well, what question did you ask?" And so the person said to me, "Well," I said, "how could you do something like that?" I said, "Well, that's not a question. That's an attack in the form of a question." So when we're not aware of what we're doing, sometimes we get into a lot of trouble. Or if I said to you, "Well, you look, I know you're kind of tired and you don't really want to be here. You know, how do you feel when someone tells you how you feel at this moment?" You know, people do that all the time, all day long, and don't realize that that's something that's very irritating and annoying.
So how can we plan the correct word choice, the tone of voice, to hold a successful conversation?
Well, it actually, what you just said is the most important thing. It's actually the tone of voice that's actually so important in a conversation. That no matter what you say, if you have a certain tone of voice, it's going to not work. Like if I said to you, "The meeting's at 10 o'clock," you know, where if I just said the meeting's at 10 o'clock, that'd be a fact. If I said the meeting's at 10 o'clock, you know, I'm kind of jumping on you. I'm kind of attacking you. So one is to be very aware of your tone of voice and to really do an inventory of what other people think about your communication. One of the things we did when we created our book is we made a website called the same name, Conversation Transformation, and it has a 10-minute pretest on it that people read before they read the book. And they take this little test, and in about 10 minutes it can tell you the areas that you're aware and the areas that you're not aware of your own communication. For example, if you use a lot of leading questions, a leading question is you actually give the person the answer that you want in the form of a question. And for instance, if you're somebody's boss, then if they say, "Well, isn't this a good idea? Don't you like this idea? Don't you think we should accept this project?" That's not really a question. That's a command, really, to answer the question in the way I want you to, kind of, or else, is the way it feels. The person's in a bit of a bind. So unless you're aware of what you're doing, you can't really change it. So that's the first step. Second step is you've got to have something in place of the other thing to replace it. So if you're asking the leading questions a lot and you're not getting a lot of information from people, you might say something like, "Do you think this is a good idea?" And then stop. You know, or, "I think this is a good idea. What do you think?" And it's, you know, whatever you think, I really want to know, rather than, "Don't you think this is a good idea," which tells the person the answer to give. So it takes a certain awareness, that it takes some skills, and then the most important thing it takes is practice. Now, you wouldn't think of learning tennis or learning baseball or basketball or writing or anything without a lot of practice. And people think, you know, they've been talking their whole life, so they know how to communicate. And unfortunately, I wish that was true, but it isn't.
So you write that all communication breakdowns. You write that all communication breakdowns can be explained by one common factor, and that's behavior. So does that mean most of us will need to change our behavior before we can successfully communicate?
Well, I don't know about most of us, but a lot of people will have to change their behavior, and particularly when things get tough. You know, like if someone is disagreeing with you, you know, if everybody's agreeing with you and everything's going great, that's usually not the hard conversation. It's when we have a disagreement with somebody, or if we feel insulted by somebody or hurt by somebody, or we get irritated with someone, that's when the conversation gets difficult. If somebody keeps complaining to us, we usually want to cut off from them or tell them, oh, it's going to be all right. Or if somebody does something we call a negative prediction, they say, well, this is never going to work out. Oh, sure, it's going to work out. So you're sort of saying what the person is saying is wrong by discounting what they're saying and saying, of course, it's going to be okay, which is what we call a positive prediction. So we do have to change our behavior, and that's where all the practice comes in. Practicing not, you know, giving leading questions, not giving negative predictions, not attacking people. So we definitely have to change our behavior. You know, they did a study recently of teachers, and they taught teachers about how to behave differently with students. And they took a whole other group of teachers, and they actually videotaped them and practiced changing their behavior. And they found that the ones that they did the videotapes and the practice of change behavior, those people actually changed tremendously, where the people who just got the theory about it didn't change hardly at all. So yes, definitely, we have to change our behavior.
I'd like to talk about you've mentioned a couple of the patterns of behavior that you say most often cause the breakdowns in communication, but I'd like to talk about the yes buts.
Okay, good.
All right, and because I think most of us were always told that that was the way to go, that you say, yes, that's true, but there's also this, and then you give alternatives to but isn't that just a matter of semantics?
Well, a yes but. Sometimes yes, but is fine. That's really attractive, but powerful. That's not a yes, but. A yes, but is when there's two different ideas. Now, that's a really great idea, but we can't do it. So it really says yes and no at the same time, and it creates some confusion in the mind of the listener. Is the person agreeing with me, or they're not agreeing with me? It's kind of like two people trying to get through a small door at the same time. In order to listen and really have a conversation, when you say yes, it means part of you agrees with what the person's saying and part of you disagrees. So we encourage people to build up what they agree with and then to ask a question that invites the other person to have a conversation with you about your point of view. If you yes, but, it ends up into what we call a polite fight. You know, yeah, that's a great idea, but it really won't work. Well, it didn't work before, but it'll work now. Well, why do you think it worked now? Well, it didn't work before, you know. So people in boardrooms and in meetings in all sorts of companies, in families, people have the same conversations over and over and over again. There's a famous quote that couples don't have hundreds of arguments. They have the same argument hundreds of times. And in companies, in businesses, in meetings, people hate meetings because they don't get anywhere. And one of the reasons meetings don't get anywhere is because of the yes-but pattern where you never really listen to the other person. You're just thinking about how you can argue with the person, and it's about being right. It's not really about getting to the best solution. So I think in the old days, you know, that was more accepted, but now we know that collaboration, cooperation is really the way to go, and it's how you are really successful, not only in your business, but in your life.
And you talked about mind reads as another pattern of behavior that causes a breakdown in communication. Why are mind reads so dangerous?
Well, it's if you made your decisions in life based on fantasies and assumptions, would that be a good thing?
No.
Not a good thing. So what a mind read is really a fantasy. It's an assumption about what another person thinks or feels that you don't know. You don't know if that's true. You know, I know how that Mary's really upset, or my boss thinks, you know, I'm not working hard enough. You know, you don't know those things are true unless you actually ask.
Right.
So when we go, or I, you know, if I think that you're mad at me right now, and I don't really know that you're mad at me, I don't even have to say it, but because if I think you're upset with me, I'm going to behave a little differently. I'm going to tiptoe around you, you know, and I'm not going to really, you know, be forthcoming, etc. So either it affects my behavior or I tell you what you think, you know. And when someone tells you what you think or feel, it's annoying, it's irritating. People, that's what starts a fight a lot of times. Or if I imagine I know, then I make all sorts of decisions based on what I know you think. And usually I'm wrong. And even if I'm right, it's still I can't be sure of that. And it's kind of annoying to the person if they think that I know what you think or feel better than you do.
Dr. Ben Benjamin, tell us about what about non-visual conversations such as we're having now? Neither Bonnie nor I have ever met you. We have no visual impression of you. How does that affect our conversation?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's two parts of the conversation. One is the content, and one is the voice tone. And we think that the voice tone includes the body language. For example, if I said, oh, yeah, great, that's going to be a great idea. What do you think I'm doing with my body if I would say something sarcastic like that? Could you imagine what I'm doing?
Sort of.
What would you say?
Kind of like, oh, yeah, like shaking your head and, you know, kind of nodding and
exactly.
Shrugging your shoulders. And
exactly. So the voice tone really contains the rolling of the eyes or the shrugging of the shoulders. You know, if I say, oh, I didn't do that. I didn't do that. You know, you can tell sort of where I am. I'm being defensive when I said that. You know, or if I said, yeah, right, you're doing a great job. You know, you get the body from the voice tone. Now, I agree with you. If you see the person, it's better. And if you write an email and you're saying very highly emotional things or very high-stakes things, that's usually not a good idea. We usually, when we're working with people, we tell people to hang a sign. If there's a potential of the person being upset by what you write in this email, do not send it. And if you're upset while you're writing it, do not send it. You know?
That's a great rule of thumb.
Yeah, because people get into all sorts of problems when they are upset and they say things in ways. And also, you don't really know what the person is, the emotion when you're looking at it. Writing only accounts for 7% of the communication. And the visual and the how-to, you know, the sound is a tremendous part of it. So we recommend that people not do high-stakes conversations in email, except to say, well, something like, I love you, you know. That's pretty high-stakes, but that's okay.
But sometimes, I mean, I can see where emails could even be more toxic than a verbal communication, but sometimes it has to be done, doesn't it? I mean, sometimes people are in a position where they have to communicate by email.
Where there's email, there's a phone. And usually we suggest that people, if you have to communicate by email, what I suggest is you have somebody else look at it. So if I have a sensitive email that I have to write and the person is in India or something and it's not easy for the time lag and stuff like that,
right.
Or failure, so I would write that email very carefully, being very explicit with how I felt, rather than leaving it open for interpretation. You know, that I'm, you know, irritated or snide or that sort of thing. So, you know, if you really craft the email to be very, very, very clear, you know, it can happen. But again, I might do better to have the conversation at 2 a.m. with the person in Australia so that I don't screw it up, you know, and I get a really good conversation. People are talking to each other across the world now, and this is a big concern. And doing it face-to-face, and now we have all kinds of things like Skype and video and stuff, all these different companies that you can really, I mean, I was in a conversation with somebody in Sweden the other day. I was looking at them, and people were in 3 different places, and we were having this great conversation, and it was terrific. And I had the verbal, and I also had the visual through the computer.
We're speaking with Dr. Ben Benjamin. We need to take a break, Dr. Benjamin, but before we do, your website, is it ctsavvy.com or is it conversationtransformation.com?
Either one will get you there.
Okay, so he's written Conversation Transformation on today's topical currents. We need to take this break, and we'll be right back. Stay with us.
You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN.
Nutcracker Key West, a uniquely crafted holiday production inspired by Key West's tropical environment and rich cultural history, with 7 shows only, from December 15th through the 21st at the Tennessee Williams Theater. You can book your tickets at keystix.com. Nutcracker Key West, you can make it a part of your Christmas. Brought to you by the Monroe County Tourist Development Council.
Isolated showers in today's forecast, a high of 82 degrees, clear as a front comes through tonight, 67 degrees for a low. Sunny, 80 degrees, and windy tomorrow with gusts up to 18 miles per hour, currently 79 degrees.
You can experience an acoustic evening with Dudu Fisher, January 10th at the Broward Center for the Performing Arts, one night only. Dudu Fisher performs his beloved repertoire of Yiddish, Israeli, and Broadway classics in a special intimate show. Through songs and stories, Dudu Fisher takes the audience on a journey through his cantorial, Broadway, and popular Israeli career. Dudu Fisher live in concert at the Broward Center. Tickets at 954-462-0222 or browardcenter.org.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman, and we're joined by Dr. Ben Benjamin. He's joining us from Cambridge, Massachusetts. He's the co-author of Conversation Transformation. Tell me, Doctor, how about when people want to tell you sort of how to react, of saying, well, calm down, or relax, and it just tends to infuriate the person.
Yeah, you put your finger right on it. When someone's upset, the natural reaction that people have is to try to calm them down, and of course that makes them worse because they're not really being understood. And one of the things we talk about in our chapter on attack is when someone's very upset and they're saying things like, you know, how could you do that? And, you know, just, you know, how, that was terrible. You know, how could you leave me like that? And so when that's happening, it's kind of counterintuitive, but what you need to do is match them, and you need to say something like, you know, so you're wondering how I could do that. You're upset with me. You know, you have to match their voice tone so they know that you're actually understanding them. You can't just say, so you're upset, and I hear that. You know, so that's really, or calm down, either way. So that's the difference between what we call paraphrasing, you know, which is where you repeat the content of what someone says, so I hear you're upset, or so I hear you're really upset, which is mirroring, which I bring in not as much emotion as you did, but I try to come just below where you were, but enough to let you know that I really understood you. And it has to be authentic. It can't be just made up. It can't be put on. It has to be an authentic kind of paraphrase with the emotion in it, which we call a mirror.
Dr. Ben Benjamin is an expert on the conversation. What do you think the conversation is like that we just heard about on the NPR News between John Boehner and the president concerning the fiscal cliff? What would be the tone of that conversation that you could imagine?
Well, the tone of that conversation would be what we call taking positions, rather than having a conversation for mutual benefit, for what is the result you want? What do you want to come out with? How can we work together? And unfortunately, people in this society, in our political structure, is very polarized in our world, and it's not easy for people to actually communicate. It's a matter of taking positions and who's going to back down first. And that's really unfortunate. They're not really interested in communicating, and people do have to be interested in communicating for it to happen.
So what would you suggest?
I would suggest that the whole Congress and the White House get some training in communication.
So, and what is your company's name again?
Conversation Transformation.
Right.
In the book. But we, you know, I may get a chance to actually do some training in Washington, and I think that would be terrific for people to be aware of, you know, are they actually talking to each other, or are they talking at each other for someone else to hear? And actually, someone made a suggestion that you have conversations in closed doors. You don't announce them. You try to really get down and talk to each other. What's possible here, you know, and not have people afraid of being revealed, you know, so to speak. So I think people ought to speak in closed doors and with a consultant to help them to actually communicate rather than to be stating positions where they're not going to get anywhere. There's a lot of really talented people in the negotiation field that could really help people in Washington to get somewhere. There's a lot of sensible solutions things that we just don't ever go near because people are, you're raised your whole life to be in opposition. No one learns how to communicate. In school you learn math, you learn reading, you learn writing, but you never learn how to communicate, how to get along with people. People think that should happen naturally. Actually, it doesn't. And with a bit of training, you know, people could be getting along a whole lot better.
Well, shouldn't that start in the family?
No, it should. But unfortunately, you bring your baggage with you. So when you're in a family, you usually repeat the mistakes of your family, unless you get some outside training. Some people get therapy. Some people have consultants. You know, some family businesses have consultants to help them get out of their habitual patterns and how they would fight with each other and argue with each other and not get anywhere. So you, if your family is functioning really well and your parents know how to deal with their anger and their sadness and their, you know, they say, speak really straightforward, how many people have grown up in a family like that? Not too many.
Not too many.
So I think, you know, the world needs to have a lot of training. I think the first subject in school should be communication every single year, 101, 102, 103, through high school. The only time you get a class in communication is when you get into college, and there it's usually about computers. But it's a real lack in this world of, you know, how many divorces we have. A woman is beaten up every 5 minutes or so in the United States alone. You know, people don't know how to actually talk to each other, so they resort to violence. Countries resort to violence. You know, people don't know how to actually talk to each other, and it's something we never really learn.
What effect has the digital world had upon young people and their verbal communication skills?
Well, some people have said that it's getting worse because people sit on their own and they're just typing these terse, you know, statements on email or Facebook or texting. I'm hopeful that when we really have a Skype type of communication done easily on iPhones and Androids, that you would actually see people in the future. You won't be actually talking to something without seeing somebody, and an email will become obsolete because there'll be voice emails with your picture, with your face on it. And that those things are available now, but we don't know if they're going to catch on. But electronic communication makes it much more difficult for people to actually connect with each other. You have to build safety and trust. You can't do that in email.
Do you think the anonymity has something to do with it?
Sure. People, when they're anonymous, they'll say all sorts of nasty things that they wouldn't say if you were looking at them. So, you know, people don't know how to communicate, and they have a lot of repressed emotions. They've had a lot of difficulties, and it comes out in all your relationships and your work relationships. You know, it comes out with your kids. It's not something you can hide or do better for the next generation unless you make a personal change, which you could do by yourself, you could do by reading, you could do by therapy, you could do by coaching, and you could do by learning it in school, learning something new.
What do you mean when you say that noise is the universal conversation killer?
Noise means, if I would say the same thing over and over and over again, you ever have a teacher who just repeated themselves over and over again, you wanted to kind of close your ears, that's called a redundancy. That's one kind of noise. Another kind of noise is ambiguity, like, that's unusual, or that was an interesting restaurant, or that was different. What is, you know, those kinds of phrases give ambiguity. That's another kind of noise that's inside a conversation. We think of physical noise, like if you're standing by a jet plane or a jackhammer, you know you're not going to be able to hear very well, and you wouldn't blame the other person. But when people have difficulty, we call it internal noise in the conversation, and that's ambiguity, redundancy, and one other called contradiction. So the contradiction I showed you before was the voice tone and the meaning. If I say, I'm not angry, you know, if I say that, you know I am angry, but I'm telling you I'm not, so there's a dissonance there. Or if I say, yes, that's a really terrific, wonderful idea, but we don't have the money for it. So I'm saying yes, I'm saying no, that's contradiction. So those kinds of things are the things that make your gut turn over. You ever been in a conversation and all of a sudden your gut says, ugh, I want to get out of here. This is not good. I don't like this. I don't know what to do. Has that ever happened to you?
Yes.
So that's what's happening then is noise. It's a kind of a verbal garbage that happens that interferes with the transfer of our information, our feelings, our ideas from one another to each other.
And what is savvy exactly? You say the system for analyzing verbal interaction. How does that work, that savvy?
Well, savvy is kind of a superpower. It's a system that was created by Anita Simon and Yvonne Agazarian over 40 years ago that gives you the ability to analyze every and any conversation every 3 seconds, so that if you listen to a conversation for 5 minutes and do what we call code it, you'll know exactly what's happening. For example, somebody asks a question and somebody gives a non-answer, and somebody says a yes but, and then somebody gives a proposal and then somebody discounts it, and then somebody gives a negative prediction. Well, we know there that conversation is not going well because we could identify every 3 seconds, every sentence, every half sentence, what that is doing to the conversation. Either it's encouraging the transfer of information smoothly, or it's blocking the transfer of information.
Dr. Ben Benjamin, I hope you haven't been analyzing this conversation too closely.
No, I only do it when things go bad.
Dr. Ben Benjamin is the author, co-author of Conversation transformation. He joined us from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Thank you very much, Doctor.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
Literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez is next.
It's Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN and 91.5 WKWM.
You can kick off your holidays early in Key West as the island comes alive with the holiday spirit. At kwholidays.com, you'll find many holiday events. The Key West Harbor Walk of Lights brings the waterfront alive every evening with the sparkle of holiday lights on the water. You can tour Victorian guesthouses with their holiday decorations in full bloom on the Key West Holiday Historic Inn Tour. kwholidays.com has the up-to-date details on all the holiday events in Key West. Brought to you by the Monroe County Tourist Development Council.
The Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at the University of Miami is a community of members aged 50 and better who are keenly interested in intellectual enrichment. Osher at UM offers lectures, speaker series, and events in a wide range of thought-provoking topics. Members can take classes at both the Coral Gables and North Bay Village locations. Memberships and gift certificates are available. The Osher Institute at UM offers a year full of new learning experiences, new friends, and events. Details at 305-284-6554.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper here, along with Bonnie Berman. Our next guest is New Yorker columnist and CNN correspondent Jeffrey Toobin. He's also a prolific author. His latest book is The Oath. It looks at the current Supreme Court composition, which, under Chief Justice John Roberts, has moved rightward. This shift, Toobin says, puts the court's conservative majority on a collision course with the Barack Obama White House. Literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez spoke with Toobin. He asked why he calls President Obama a conservative and Chief Justice Roberts a radical.
If you look at the controversies over the Constitution since the 1980s, it's been conservatives who have been pushing for change, you know, ending constitutional protection of abortion, ending affirmative action, expanding the death penalty, the whole Citizens United constellation of cases, you know, deregulating American campaigns. All of that is an agenda for change, and all of that is John Roberts' agenda. What Barack Obama and company have been doing is basically holding up their hands and saying, no, stop, just leave things the way they are. That's a big difference between the two of them.
Well, throughout our history, the Supreme Court has been a conservative institution. Up until Franklin D. Roosevelt, because he was president for 12 years, he had the chance to, I think he filled every seat on the court. Some of them were prominent liberals like Hugo Black and William Douglas.
Certainly. Yeah.
Then Earl Warren came in, appointed by Eisenhower, and you had the most liberal court, I think, in history, the
Certainly.
Warren Court. Is it Roberts' goal to take us back to a pre-Warren, pre-New Deal mindset?
Well, I think that's probably more extreme than John Roberts is. I think, you know, if you think about the New Deal court, the court that Franklin Roosevelt installed, its great mission was to create a legal justification for the welfare state. For because remember, the Supreme Court was a great adversary of Franklin Roosevelt during his first term in office, which led him to his ill-fated court packing plan. So the definition of what the government could do in the economy was something that all the Roosevelt appointees were united. To jump to the healthcare case, if the healthcare law had been overturned, I think that really would have been a return to the pre-New Deal court. Roberts, of course, was the one who swung to the side of the liberals in that one case and said, no, we're not going to go that far. And so I think that tells us that he is not ready to go back to the pre-New Deal court, but he very well might be able to go back to the pre-Warren court, which, you know, the Warren court, you know, its great contribution, I think, was the real protection of civil liberties and, an interest in racial integration. Those two things, I think, are very much in jeopardy if Roberts commands a substantial majority on the court.
Currently, there are four hardline conservatives on the court: Roberts, Antonin Scalia, Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito. To get a majority, they need a fifth vote. Usually, that fifth vote is, actually, all the time, I think that fifth vote is Anthony Kennedy. Kennedy is viewed by many as a moderate, but in your book, you call him an extremist of varied enthusiasms. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, it is. There's a big tendency to refer to Anthony Kennedy as a moderate because he is the swing vote in so many cases, and he does go back and forth between the four liberals and the four conservatives on certain issues. But it is not that he is a moderate. Sandra Day O'Connor was a moderate. Sandra Day O'Connor, in controversial cases, went out of her way to give one side 51% and the other side 49%. She would try to slice the bologna very thin. Anthony Kennedy doesn't do that. Anthony Kennedy has big ideas about the Constitution. Citizens United is a big case that could have been decided on much narrower grounds, but Anthony Kennedy decided to rewrite 100 years of constitutional law because of his beliefs about the First Amendment. He is also someone who has been a strong defender of gay rights. He's the author of the two most important gay rights decisions in the Supreme Court, Lawrence v. Texas and the Romer case. So he has varied enthusiasms, as I write in the Oath. But they are not predictable enthusiasms the way it is for the way they are for the other eight justices on the court.
He's also been more liberal on issues dealing with torture and immigration.
Right. One way of looking at Justice Kennedy's views, it's imperfect but I think useful, is Justice Kennedy is someone who really, he travels a great deal. He spends every summer in Salzburg. He feels very much a part of the international collection community of judges. And if you look at the issues on which he is more liberal, the death penalty, the Geneva Conventions, gay rights, those are issues in which there is a strong international consensus against the United States. When it comes to more purely domestic issues like Citizens United, like the healthcare case, that's where he tends to be on the more conservative side.
We're speaking with author Jeffrey Toobin about his new book, The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court. You mentioned Sandra Day O'Connor a moment ago. In 2005, O'Connor retired. This allowed George W. Bush to fill her seat with a radical conservative, Samuel Alito. As you said, O'Connor is no liberal, but she's certainly no right-wing conservative. You write in your book that she has spent an unquiet retirement. She detested the Bush administration. She thought the Iraq War was a mistake. She felt that their policies on torture and wiretapping were unconstitutional. She also has been very upset with the Roberts Court. She thinks it is systematically unraveling her legacy. But for some people, it's difficult to feel sorry for her because she did cast the deciding vote in Bush v. Gore, which gave the presidency to George W. Bush. And she could have not retired. She could have waited until a Democrat came into the White House and had a more moderating influence on this court. So does she have any regret or remorse for her actions?
Well, to know Justice O'Connor, as I'm privileged to do, is to know that the word regret is not in her vocabulary. She is a forward-thinking Westerner. She is not someone who agonizes about the past. In her heart of hearts, does she regret turning her seat over to George W. Bush? My guess is she does, but that's just a guess. I can't claim any inside knowledge there. I think Justice O'Connor's departure from the court really illustrates a theme about the Supreme Court, but also a larger theme about American politics, which is the disappearance of moderate Republicans. They are gone from the United States Senate, which they used to dominate. They are gone from the Supreme Court. You know, in the 1960s, there was Potter Stewart. In the 1970s, there was Lewis Powell. In the 1980s and 90s, there was Sandra Day O'Connor, David Souter. They are all gone from the Supreme Court. And George W. Bush appointed justices in the mode of the modern Republican Party, which is far more conservative. And that is that that's how generally it works at the Supreme Court, that the trends in presidential politics in our broader political system show up at the Supreme Court, and presidents by and large get what they want.
Well, let's talk about two of these immoderate conservatives on the court. Antonin Scalia is the senior justice. He has been there since 1986, I think. He did not take the healthcare decision well. In fact, lately, he's been acting a little weird. What's his problem?
Well, you know, I've certainly been very critical of Justice Scalia, but I think it's important to recognize that there is no more important justice who served on the court in the last 25 years. I mean, this is a justice who really created, along with Robert Bork, a whole new school of constitutional interpretation called originalism, which means interpreting the Constitution as it was understood by the framers of the Constitution, and brought it to tremendous prominence and wide acceptance in the Supreme Court and beyond it. And that's a tremendous contribution, whether you agree with it or not. So, I mean, he is an enormously influential justice. He's getting older. He's 76. There's a reason why most people quit their jobs at 76 or well before, because they're tired of it. They're ready to move on. But with a Democrat in the White House, Antonin Scalia is going nowhere voluntarily. And I think he's getting older, he's getting crankier, and he's getting more partisan. You know, I write in the Oath that you know, some of his behavior at the end of the 2011-2012 term suggested his evolution from conservative intellectual into right-wing crank. And unfortunately, I think there was plenty of evidence to support my conclusion.
Well, Clarence Thomas doesn't have that excuse. He's younger. How bitter is Clarence Thomas?
You know, Thomas is a paradoxical figure because at one level, he is very popular among his colleagues. He is an outgoing, friendly presence at the Supreme Court. But if you scratch beneath the surface and if you see what he wrote in his autobiography, if you see the views he expresses in his speeches, you see the bitterness from the Anita Hill hearings, which 21 years later, he is still not over. And he's not one thing. He is both very popular and outgoing and very bitter. You know, people are complicated.
Well, we need to take a break. When we return, we'll continue speaking with best-selling author Jeffrey Toobin. I'm Ariel Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN.
Old Island Restoration Foundation presents its annual Holiday House Tour December 27th and 28th in Key West from 4 to 8 p.m. each day. You can stroll the town's side streets and narrow lanes where sparkling lights and flickering candles beckon you to enter homes large and small. Tickets available at oirf.org or 305-294-9501 for ticket locations in the Keys. Additional tours January, February, and March brought to you by the Monroe County Tourist Development Council.
Isolated showers in the forecast today, otherwise partly cloudy, a high of 82 degrees. A minor cold front comes through tonight, bringing the temperatures down to about 67 degrees. The winds pick up tomorrow. It'll be sunny, though, with a high of 80. Wind gusts up to 18 miles per hour tomorrow. Current temperature is 80 degrees.
Welcome back. I'm Ariel Gonzalez, and this is Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Our guest today is author and CNN legal analyst Jeffrey Toobin, whose latest book is The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court. Is Roe versus Wade safe, or is it in jeopardy?
For the next 4 years, it's safe, no doubt about it. You know, there are not many bedrock principles of the Democratic Party and Democratic judges, but one of them is that the right to an abortion is protected by the Constitution. And there are now five justices, the four liberals and Anthony Kennedy, who have said Roe v. Wade should not be overturned. And Barack Obama will certainly appoint justices who protect that right if he has the choice to appoint anyone. So for the next 4 years, no question, it's safe.
Okay, what about voting rights and affirmative action? How likely are we going to see changes on those two issues?
Very likely to see change. I mean, because this is an issue where Justice Kennedy has sided consistently with the conservatives. And the University of Texas admissions case, which was just argued a month or so ago, really raises almost identically the same issue that was raised in 2003 in the Grutter case out of the University of Michigan Law School, which is basically, can a university consider race as one factor among many in admissions? And Justice O'Connor's opinion said yes. And the clear indication from the oral argument was that the answer is soon going to be no. And that's a big change. They also are looking at shortly the Voting Rights Act, Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, about whether states, mostly in the South, have to have their electoral changes reviewed in the Justice Department, as they have had since 1965 in the Voting Rights Act. And I think that's probably in serious jeopardy as well.
But will they throw out the entire Voting Rights Act, or just part of it?
Well, which only part of it is up, but it's certainly a very important part. Section 5, which says that certain defined areas, of Florida is among them, have to go to Washington to get their when they change their voting rights. And you know, when Governor Scott put in all these new voter ID laws, the Justice Department did step in and got some of them changed. So this is not some abstract controversy. This is really a big deal, potentially, especially for Florida.
We're speaking with author Jeffrey Toobin about his new book, The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court. How has Roberts manipulated judicial procedure to keep underdog-friendly cases from coming to the court?
Well, I think manipulate suggests there's something sort of unfair or untoward about what he was doing. You know, he has a judicial philosophy. And that judicial philosophy means, which is very skeptical of plaintiffs bringing cases, whether it's securities cases, whether it's personal injury cases, whether it's class action cases, whether it's discrimination cases. By and large, John Roberts, based on his judicial philosophy, based on his career as a prominent defense lawyer, is sympathetic to defendants in civil cases. And one way that defendants have won these cases so much in recent years, especially at the Supreme Court, have been these procedural doctrines that knock plaintiffs out of the box even before they bring the merits of their case. Statute of limitations, you filed the case too late. Ripeness, you filed the case too early. Justiciability, it's not really a case that the court should hear. These are all procedural doctrines that sound very boring and very procedural, but in fact have enormous significance because they throw plaintiffs out of court. And Roberts has been a master of using them to make it harder to bring any sorts of cases.
Let's turn to President Obama. He's appointed two justices, Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan. You praise those justices, but you're critical about his lower court appointments. What has he done wrong, in your opinion?
Well, it's mostly a question of volume. He just hasn't appointed enough of them. You know, this is an enormous opportunity for presidents to shape the judiciary and thus the country for decades after they leave office. There are still dozens of judges on the bench, including two on the Supreme Court, who were appointed by Ronald Reagan, who hasn't been president for quite a long time. Obama has shown remarkably little interest in this process. He has not filled all the vacancies available. He has never talked about the Constitution publicly, unlike George W. Bush, who had a real judicial philosophy that he talked about all the time. You know, judges shouldn't legislate from the bench, which is a phrase very much associated with President Bush. Obama has really sort of kicked the can down the road on this on this area. Now, in fairness, he had a very busy 4 years. He had two wars to deal with. He had an economy that was collapsing. He reformed health care. It's not that he's just been sitting around.
And he had Republican obstructionists.
Well, and I think that is a key factor, that the Republicans obstructed his judicial nominees in an unprecedented way. However, you know, you can still appoint judges. Nothing was stopping him. And so I think one of the very interesting things to follow in the next 4 years is whether the president, as he starts to think about his legacy, and now with an expanded majority in the Senate, at least for the next 2 years, he tries to push through more judges.
Well, it's likely that Ruth Bader Ginsburg is going to retire in the next 4 years.
That's right.
You know, she's been 70, sick.
79 years old.
Yeah, she's been sick. She's, you know, her husband died a little while ago. Or even two, Stephen Breyer is tired, as you write in your book, of writing dissents. He doesn't want to write dissents anymore. So you may not be able to answer this, but who do you think is a leading candidate for the next seat? Is there someone in the pipeline?
Well, there are a lot of candidates who are possibilities. The real decision Obama has to make is, does he want to do a judge again? The Supreme Court that decided Brown v. Board of Education in 1954, not one of the justices had ever been a full-time judge before. You know, Earl Warren was governor of California, Hugo Black was a senator. The court doesn't have anyone like that anymore. You know, Elena Kagan wasn't a judge, but she was dean of Harvard Law School, which was sort of judge-like. There are lots of potential candidates out there who were not judges, who could bring something else to the bench. Kamala Harris, the Attorney General of California, is a possibility. Deval Patrick, the Governor of Massachusetts, is a possibility. Janet Napolitano, the Secretary of Health and Human Services. People who have different life experiences than legal academics who have been mostly on the court. Now, if he decides to go the judge route, there are possibilities like Merrick Garland on the D.C. Circuit, Sri Srinivasan, who is a nominee for the D.C. Circuit, Goodwin Liu, who's a justice on the California Supreme Court, Paul Watford, judge on the Ninth Circuit. I mean, these are less familiar names to people, and those would be more traditional nominees. But, I think the court is really missing something when it doesn't have someone like Sandra Day O'Connor, who had run for office and knows these issues from a different perspective.
We're speaking with author Jeffrey Toobin about his new book, The Oath. The Oath refers to the oath of office. Now, you begin the book with the circumstances behind the botched oath of office administered by John Roberts to Barack Obama at the inauguration. What happened there?
Well, one of the great things about being a journalist is you get to watch history unfold. But one of the not so great things about being a journalist is the circus moves on very quickly. And things that seem important just get lost in the wayside. The oath was botched. And I went back a few years later and said, what the heck happened? Why was it so screwed up? And there's a story there. The story at its heart is one of a misplaced email that Roberts and his staff went over the oath very carefully and printed it out on a card, which they emailed a PDF to the secretary on the congressional committee that was supervising the inauguration. Well, that secretary either never read the email, ignored it, deleted it, but never forwarded it to Obama's office. So Obama did not know how Roberts was going to divide the words. You know, a lot of people criticized Roberts sort of blowing it off, not preparing enough, completely unfair criticism. In fact, he rehearsed so many times, his wife said to him, at this point, the dog thinks it's the president. So it wasn't a question of lack of preparation. What happened was Roberts was startled by Obama not going by the script that Roberts thought was going on, and then Roberts uncharacteristically got flustered.
And then they had to do it again the next day.
They did it again the next day, and which is a story I tell in the prologue to The Oath, that the whole oath story, which I tell in part just because it's an interesting story that had never been told before, but also because it serves as a useful metaphor for the conflict between my two protagonists, Obama and Roberts.
Well, soon he's going to have another chance. And then they'll finally have an unblemished YouTube moment.
I have to say one of the things I thought of when Obama got reelected is, boy, I can't wait to January 20th, 21st actually, because it's 20th is a Sunday, and see them try to do it again.
Well, thank you for coming in.
Good to
be
here.
Speaker Jeffrey Toobin.
Gonzalez is an English professor at Miami-Dade College. And that wraps up today's edition. Our producer is Richard Ive, technical direction by Peter J. Paul Leary is online producer. We have free audio archives and digital downloads of our program at the website WLRN.org. And check out the Topical Currents Facebook page for author and book links, discussions, and more. Tomorrow's program is with author Les Standiford. He chronicles the Sons of Liberty, which sparked the American Revolution. And today's calendar, on this day in 1943, 69 years ago, the birth of Rolling Stone guitarist and composer Keith Richards in Dartmouth, Kent, England. He and Mick Jagger went to the same elementary school. A critic said Richards was mad, bad, and dangerous to know. And on this day in 1963, 49 years ago, the birth of actor Brad Pitt in Shawnee, Oklahoma. Raised as a Southern Baptist, his step to stardom began as the seducer in Thelma and Louise. One more before we dance. On this day in 1980, 32 years ago, the birth of Christina Aguilera in Staten Island. She grew up in Pittsburgh. Of Hispanic and Irish descent, she said to have a four-octave voice. Her biggest influence musically, the great Etta James, At Last. And we leave with a thought from Keith Richards, whose great influence was Chuck Berry. He could play all of Berry's guitar solos while in high school. Quote from Richards, "I remember a sense of doom when our first record got in the top 20. It was conventional wisdom at the time that it would all be over in 2 years." This is Joseph Cooper for Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
You're tuned to South Florida's NPR.